News of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. At least 9 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured Wednesday by a powerful earthquake in Taiwan. Dozens of buildings were seriously damaged in the quake, which prompted tsunami warnings as far as Japan and the Philippines before being lifted. Dozens of people were believed safe but unreachable in areas cut off by massive landslides triggered by the quake. The quake was the strongest to hit Taiwan in 25 years. U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are scheduled to speak for the first time Thursday since last month amid growing frustration of Israel's handling of the Gaza war. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
A U.S. official says the call will come Thursday after an Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers.
He's outraged. He's heartbroken.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and National Security Spokesman John Kirby say while Israel has the right to defend itself against Hamas,
as a modern military and a democracy, they have obligations to the innocent people of Gaza. And they have not always met those obligations.
The two leaders last spoke more than 2 weeks ago. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is demanding accountability for Monday's airstrikes by Israeli warplanes in Gaza that killed 7 aid workers.
And what isn't good enough is the statements that have been made, including that this is just a product of war. This is against humanitarian law. International humanitarian law makes it very clear that aid workers should be able to provide that aid and that assistance free of the threat of losing their life.
Albanese was apparently referring to comments by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after the airstrikes. This is VOA News. Australian national Zomi Frankum was among the 7 people killed who were while delivering food for the global charity World Central Kitchen. Albanese said Frankum was traveling in a vehicle clearly identified as an aid vehicle and should not have been at risk. He demanded full accountability on a call with Netanyahu on Wednesday. Finland's president on Wednesday signed a 10-year security deal with Ukraine in Kyiv. The pact made Finland the 8th NATO member this year to commit to long-term security cooperation and defense backing for Kyiv as it battles to hold back Russian forces. Finland shares a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia. The nation joined NATO a year ago. The U.S. prosecutor leading the case against Donald Trump for keeping classified documents after leaving the White House pushed back against the federal judge in the case after she signaled she may accept the former president's claim that the records were his personal property. Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam reports.
U.S. Special Counsel Jack Smith called Trump's claim a, quote, fundamentally flawed legal premise and said his office would appeal any decision by U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon that would instruct jurors to consider it. Cannon, who was appointed to the bench by Trump, has signaled she is receptive to Trump's claim that he treated the documents as personal under a 1978 law called the Presidential Records Act that let former presidents keep records that have no connection to their official responsibilities. Smith said the documents relate to U.S. military and intelligence matters, including details about the American nuclear program, and could not be construed as personal.
That was Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam. A man from the U.S. northwestern state of Washington, who used a megaphone to orchestrate the mob's attack on police officers guarding the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, has been sentenced to more than 7 years in prison. Here's AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
Judge Royce Lambert says video shows Taylor Jonatakis from Washington State barking commands over his megaphone, giving step-by-step directions for overpowering officers. He said in any angry mob, there are leaders and followers, and Jonatakis was a leader. The self-employed installer of septic systems represented himself at trial. The judge referred to some of Jonatakis' words as gobbledygook. Several hours after he left the Capitol January 6th, Jonatakis posted on social media, the crime is complete. Ed Donahue, Washington.
International Edition delivers insight into world news through eyewitnesses, correspondent reports, and analysis from experts and newsmakers. We also keep you in touch with social media, science, and entertainment trends. That's VOA's International Edition. I'm Richard Green for VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butler in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's constitutional court refuses to block the enforcement of an anti-gay law.
They were looking at perceptions. They were looking at what the media was saying rather than what the actual facts were. If you're talking about recruitment, but you do not have any evidence of recruitment, except statements from an individual that have not been substantiated, it is a sad day.
We will speak with one of the petitioners in the case. South Africa's Speaker of Parliament resigns over corruption allegations. Some Guinean political parties will no longer recognize the military junta if it does not return the country to democratic rule by December 31st. Zimbabwe appeals for $2 billion to avert food insecurity.
By this declaration, I also call upon all Zimbabweans of goodwill, including those in the diaspora, to generously donate towards ameliorating this state of national disaster.
The Nigerians are sounding the alarm over rising cases of meningitis in several northern states. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's constitutional court has declined to annul or grant a permanent injunction against the enforcement of the country's anti-gay law. In their ruling Wednesday, the judges said the law does, however, infringe on some fundamental human rights. Lawyers representing members of Uganda's LGBT community described the ruling as retrogressive. Halima Atumani reports from Uganda's capital.
The petitioners in the case had sought to have the court decide whether the anti-gay law passed in 2023 violates the principle of equal protection under the law for all Ugandans. But to their dismay, the panel of five judges led by Uganda's Deputy Chief Justice Richard Butera had this to announce.
We decline to nullify the Anti-Homosexuality Act 2023 in its entirety. Neither would we grant a permanent injunction against its enforcement.
In their ruling Wednesday, the Constitutional Court judges had noted that the law was meant to protect children, especially in cases where recruitment and targeting of children has been reported. However, the judges did rule that the law does infringe on some rights, specifically parts of the law that would effectively deny members of the LGBT community access to health services such as anti-HIV treatment.
We find that Section 3.2c violates the right to health, while Articles 9 and 11.2d of the Anti-Homosexuality Act are inconsistent with the right to adequate standard of
The ruling nullified those sections of the Act. Lawyer Nicholas Opio described the whole ruling as an inherently faulty judgment of the court. He argues that the court's decision makes it legal and lawful to discriminate against LGBT people.
That it is legal to exclude the LGBTI community from participating in the affairs of their country, simply on the basis of public sentiments and alleged cultural values. What is to say you have access to health when your very existence is being challenged and being declared unconstitutional? I think that it's a failed attempt at a balancing act.
Eric Ndaula, an LGBT activist, told VOA that the community was let down by the court.
They did not have facts, but rather they were looking at perceptions. They were looking at what the media was saying rather than what the actual facts were. If you're talking about recruitment, but you do not have any evidence of recruitment, except statements from an individual that have not been substantiated, it is a sad day.
The petitioners can appeal the matter to Uganda's Supreme Court. The Anti-Homosexuality Act, which took effect last May, says engaging in acts of homosexuality is punishable with life imprisonment. The law also imposes the death penalty for what it calls aggravated homosexuality, including sexual relations involving people infected with HIV, as well as sex with people categorized as vulnerable, including minors and the elderly. The law has been denounced by gay activists and many foreign governments, including the Biden administration, as a violation of human rights. Halima Asmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Uganda's Constitutional Court on Wednesday largely upheld an anti-gay law that has been roundly condemned internationally as one of the toughest in the world. Human rights advocate Nicholas Opio is one of the petitioners. He tells Piers Douglas Mpuga that he is not surprised by the Constitutional Court's ruling, but they intend to appeal to the Supreme Court.
Many of us who are engaged in this constitutional petition knew that this court was going to deliver a judgment in the way that they have. However, what is really surprising is the basis of their reasoning. The court essentially cites public sentiments, public morals, common good as a basis for its decision. That was surprising because you go to court believing the court will apply the law and not public sentiments. Secondly, the court makes a decision based on false, unsubstantiated allegations of recruitment of children into homosexuality and says because of this, anti-homosexuality law is therefore unassailable. I think those were the most surprising things, given that these allegations are false and not proven, and in fact, outright lies. But in terms of the conservative bend of the court, nobody really expected anything better from them.
So then in that case, what's your next move then?
We'll definitely appeal this decision to the Supreme Court. We hope that the Supreme Court will apply the law in a more progressive manner and not based on public sentiment. Additionally, we also alert the fact that this debate may not necessarily be resolved in the courtroom, given the limitations of the court and the court's inability to stand up to the majority tyranny in Uganda against the LGBTI community. We shall continue to take this debate to the public arena, first exposing the disinformation that has been the basis of this law, so the public can decide whether these lies justify the law that they support. But secondly, exposing those who are promoting homophobia, because there are those who have gone beyond just advocating for a law and are asking for the execution and the killings of gay people in Uganda. A member of parliament even said they should be castrated. We will expose these individuals for who they are and what they are doing. And lastly, many of them are saying this is about African culture, this is African values. We will show that, in fact, African societies had same-sex conduct before contact with the global West, and that if anybody cared to look down our history, it is replete with evidence of same-sex conduct. What is, in fact, imported is hatred.
As you plan to appeal this ruling, the court didn't grant an injunction against its enforcement. What does that mean?
Well, we had not applied for injunction. We had applied for the court to nullify the entire law, and the consequence of that prayer was that the court would stop the state from enforcing any of the provisions of the law. But since the court upheld the law, the request for an injunction, therefore, became a moot question. So if we choose to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, we will ask the Supreme Court to issue an interim injunction against implementation of the decision of the Constitutional Court, pending or abiding the outcome of the appeal in the Supreme Court.
Nicholas Opio is the lead lawyer for the petitioners in the Uganda anti-LGBTQ bill case. He was speaking from Kampala with Viewers Douglas Mpuga. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the United States continues to be deeply concerned by reports of human rights abuses in Uganda, including against the LGBTQ community. He said in a statement on Wednesday that the announcement that some provisions of the Anti-Homosexuality Act have been removed by the Constitutional Court is a small and insufficient step towards safeguarding human rights. The remaining provisions of the law pose grave threats to the Ugandan people, especially LGBTQ plus Ugandans and their allies, undermine public health, clamp down on civil space, damage Uganda's international reputation, and harm efforts to increase foreign investment. Secretary Blinken said Uganda should respect the human dignity of all and provide equal protection to all individuals under the law. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 4th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A political analyst says South Africa's Speaker of Parliament did the honorable thing for the ruling African National Congress, the ANC party, by resigning. She has been accused of soliciting bribes worth about $240,000 from a defense contractor between 2016 and 2019 when she was Minister of Defense and Military Veterans. She said Wednesday that her resignation was not an indication or admission of guilt. Professor Sipho Sipe is a former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He tells me it was simply a matter of time before the National Prosecuting Authority would arrest the Speaker.
The Speaker of Parliament had little choice, and the people of South Africa would have welcomed her removal. But with this, she has made life easy for the opposition. The opposition had already tabled a motion of no confidence in her, which the ANC would have found itself in a corner. They would have been forced to support it. But the chairperson of the ANC had indicated that the party was not going to do that. So what the Speaker has done is to remove the conundrum the ANC was facing, because the ANC does not like to have its leaders removed by the opposition. And at the same time, the ANC was faced with a conundrum where they supported a clearly flawed Ramaphosa with the power parameter and voted against the report that said Ramaphosa has a case to answer. So they would have been shown to have been inconsistent if they had supported the removal of the Speaker of Parliament. And secondly, the ANC has a policy that says anybody who gets criminally charged must step aside. With the National Prosecuting Authority having expressed an intention to arrest her and to charge her, it was simply a matter of time. So rather than to wait to be charged, she has done what people may call the honorable thing, to simply resign before she's actually pushed out by a party.
Professor, the Speaker has been quoted as saying that her resignation is in no way an admission of guilt. What's next? First, let's talk about any legal ramification.
Well, the position of the NPA is very clear. She's going to be charged. It doesn't matter what she thinks. It is up to the prosecution authority to make a strong case for whoever they are charging, to say there was a case and the court will rule on the basis of that.
So, Professor, as you said, she did the honorable thing politically now. So does this mean that the ANC now is clear, especially as we politically look ahead to election?
Oh, definitely. The ANC has been saved the challenge of having to fire her. And if they fired her, it will also have looked back on the ANC, because the people are saying, what about Ramaphosa? Because Ramaphosa is also equally guilty. So by her resignation, it makes it easier for the ANC to at least not have to deal with that dirty work.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Zimbabwe has appealed to the United Nations, aid agencies and citizens for $2 billion to avert food insecurity caused by current El Nino-induced drought. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, analysts say Zimbabwe wants a breadbasket of the region could mitigate the drought if it fixes its irrigation systems, which displaced commercial farmers used to depend on.
At the State House in Harare, President Emmerson Mnangagwa told reporters Wednesday that Zimbabwe is expecting a harvest of 868,000 metric tons of grain this year, a number far short of expectations and about 680,000 tons less than the country needs. Mnangagwa attributed that to El Nino-induced drought, which made him declare a nationwide state of disaster in Zimbabwe.
By this declaration, I also call upon all Zimbabweans of goodwill, including those in the diaspora, the international community, the private sector, churches and other faith-based organizations, as well as individuals, to generously donate towards ameliorating this state of national disaster.
Malawi and Zambia declared a state of disaster earlier this year due to the drought ravaging the region. Edward Kaloni, UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Zimbabwe, said the world body is monitoring the severe impact of the ongoing dry spell in the Southern African region.
So far, the UN, as part of the National Anticipatory Action and Early Response, allocated $5 million from the Central Emergency Response Fund in December 2023. The UN pledges to support the government of Zimbabwe in mobilizing resources to tackle the El Nino-induced drought, and efforts are underway to finalize a response plan focusing on food security, health, education, shelter, and other essential areas to address the needs of those affected by the crisis.
Paul Zakaria, Executive Director of Zimbabwe Farmers Union, says while nothing can be done to stop climate change effects, irrigation farming is one of the methods that can be used to mitigate when the calamity visits.
We also take on board irrigation. This is real. This is where the world is going. Only depending on rain-fed agriculture, we will not go too far. And also government to put effort in ensuring that even smallholder farmers are able to irrigate, and ensuring that with irrigation, our farmers are producing all year round. And beyond that, we will need to rely on reliable weather information.
Zimbabwe, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, is largely dependent on handouts from organizations like the World Food Programme and the U.S. Agency for International Development in the last 20-plus years. The government attributes the food shortages to recurring droughts like the one currently hitting the region. Critics attribute the problem to the confiscation of land from white commercial farmers who used to produce crops all year round. UN agencies say they will provide funding so Zimbabwe can revive the irrigation schemes. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare.
The coalition of political parties and civil society groups in Guinea says it will no longer recognize the military junta if it does not return the country to democratic rule by December 31, 2024. Prime Minister Mamadou Ouré Ba, appointed last month, has asked the members of the opposition to agree to extend the transition period until 2025. He cited the need for more time to hold a national census and the preparation of an electoral list. But, as Karim Kamara reports from Conakry, some of the opposition say extending the transition is not acceptable.
Addressing members of the opposition who turn up at a meeting with the Prime Minister at the Palais de Colombe, Prime Minister Baouri urged his guests to accept the postponement of the transition period until next year. He told the opposition that it is practically impossible to hold elections at the end of 2024 as initially planned. The Prime Minister says at the same time, the government also has to deal with economic hardships. He says the need to finalize the planning of the national census needed for the creation of a registration list and electoral list. He says after the establishment of the electoral list by the end of this year, there will be a constitutional referendum. He says the objective is to finish all these procedures this year and elections in 2025. The idea has widely been rejected and criticized by the opposition. Ibrahim Diallo is a member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, or FNDC, a combination of political and social groups here in Guinea. He says it is not up to the military junta to reform the process or to search for international financial partners now. He says that is the responsibility of a democratically elected government. He says it's under a constitutional order that we can go out in search of international financial institutions to help face the social and economic crisis. The junta, who seized power in a military coup in 2020 after it overthrew the country's democratically elected President Alpha Conde, promised the sub-regional body ECOWAS and the international community that it will return the country to a constitutional order on the 31st December 2024. Dr. Edward Zotomo, an influential politician and a member of the opposition, described the Prime Minister's statement as a breach of trust by the junta. He accused the Prime Minister of being in hot of the military and says they will not accept an extension of the transition beyond the end of the year.
Between ECOWAS and the junta, it was not a matter of actually permitting them to not hold the election later than this December 31st, 2024. So Mr. Bawuri is what I call the civilian portion of the junta. Now, what he wants to do is come to try to help the junta silence completely the opposition so that to stay in power. December 31st, 2024 is the date the transition will end. Anything after that, we are not going to accept it.
Botswana's favor holding the elections in 2025. They include other political parties such as PDN of former Prime Minister Lansana Kwiyete, the Liberal Bloc of Dr. Fayamili Mono, PADES of former Finance Minister Dr. Usman Kabah, and the Party of the Union of Democrats for Renaissance of current Prime Minister Bawuri. This latest development has contributed to worsening the already deteriorating relationship between the junta and the opposition. The opposition is calling on its supporters to be on the alert for further action and says it will no longer recognize the military junta after December 31st. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
Health authorities in Nigeria are sounding the alarm over rising cases of meningitis in several northern states, warning of an outbreak if not contained. Dr. Kachi Mwoga is an epidemiologist. He tells VOA's Chinedu Ofor that the country is struggling to deal with the outbreak following reports of deaths in rural areas.
Is absolutely right. In public health, that's affecting more people. The ingredients are there for it to spread. You have to start alarming early enough and start taking measures early enough so that you can prevent an escalation into a full-blown epidemic. This is the season for meningitis. Every year we go through this at a time when the heat is high, humidity is low, a vulnerable period.
Now, you talked about action should be taken promptly to take care of an outbreak. Has the Nigerian government taken such an action?
This happens every year. So there's a level of preparation already in the system. And this system is going on vaccinating people and making people aware by way of advocacy, by way of publicity, that such a thing exists, and telling them the measures, both medical and non-medical measures, that you can use to prevent it. The issue of insecurity affects vaccination. It makes it more difficult for going to the hinterlands and do vaccinations the way they would ordinarily do. So those are some of the factors.
Critics of the government say this is a unique period unlike before. There is widespread hunger, there's widespread economic crisis, and that people would rather find something to eat than just show up at a place to get vaccination.
This situation is not peculiar to Nigeria. Even though the hunger level is so high, maybe that's the one that is far more significant now. There are definitely many areas that are not covered still. So there's still work to be done. Just as there are people who will deny the vaccination, there are many who are actually going for the vaccination. My advice to all is that you have to be alive to even eat.
Experts are saying the most vulnerable group in the population are children and pregnant mothers. How should they stay safe?
The basic measures are hygiene, home hygiene. Avoid overcrowding and overcrowded places. Identify children who are coughing, keep them away from others. Please go and get vaccinated. The vaccination is available in public health. Meningitis was added to the essential vaccines given to children free of charge in Nigeria. Don't do home care and make diagnosis on your own. There are simple clinical tests before you start going into complex medical laboratory tests, before it gets into a full-blown illness and people can identify that the disease has come early. So I would say that people should just deploy these things I have said. It will help to keep the disease significantly away.
That was Dr. Kachi Mwoga, an epidemiologist. He spoke with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Sokoto State. And that's it for this Thursday, April 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning on behalf of the Daybreak Africa team. I am James Butting, Washington State. Have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.